www.thebeatlesonline.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Today's guest is a member of America's first family of jazz, Wynton Marsalis. That's Wynton Marsalis on his very first recording as a band leader at the age of 19. Wynton, of course, plays trumpet. That's his brother Branford on sax. His other brother, Stelfio, who has been on this program, and Jason, plus his father Ellis, also play and do so at the highest levels of music, creating a kind of musical dynasty. Last night, Wynton Marsalis, who created Jazz at Lincoln Center, brought the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra to Charlotte, along with the 70-member Abyssinian Baptist Choir from Harlem, to perform Abyssinian Mass. And he joins us this morning to talk about music and more. There we go. Wynton Marsalis, welcome to Charlotte. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to see you. You came to town, as I said, last night at the Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, which must have been a rollicking night considering the piece of music you've played. You've never toured with Abyssinian Mass before now.
No. And the choir we're touring with is Chorale Le Chateau, mm-hmm. under the direction of Damien Sneed. And it's over 87 people or something. So it's quite an enterprise.
And that's why you never toured with it before, correct?
Probably never will tour with it again.
So I was going to ask, why now? What's the difference? What made you do it?
We have a great sponsor from St. Louis, David Stewart, the David Stewart Foundation. He's a man of faith, and he wanted to do something, bring to the country something, a work of art like this. He believes in the work and in what's expressed. So he made it possible for us to go on this tour.
So the orchestra is how many pieces?
The orchestra is 15.
15 plus
70-piece choir.
Yeah, that's a lot of travel logistics.
A lot of road issues.
This tour began, I understand, in Chapel Hill. Charlotte's just one of the stops that include Washington and New Orleans and Houston and Dallas and many other cities. How did we get in on this?
I don't know the mechanics of it, how
you
to
just
tour
go where you're
together.
Told.
Yeah, I basically just go where I'm told, and I've been touring for so many years that I've been in a lot of the communities, and this is one of the great communities to come into. I used to come here really a lot in the 80s and the early 90s.
Really?
So, oh, yeah, a lot of
people. Do you remember where you played?
I played in clubs. Yeah, I've played here in this facility.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I've played around. I've been here.
And you actually remember that?
Oh, yeah. I remember places. I remember people. I remember halls. Like, if I stand on a stage, I have a pretty good memory for it. But I really remember the people that I meet.
Mm. Talk about Abyssinian Mass. I know that people missed it if they didn't see it last night because you're moving on to other cities and other things. But talk about it. You wrote this to commemorate the bicentennial of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York. When you sit down to do something like this, what goes through your mind? How do you write a piece of music that does what that piece does?
Well, first, I have a lot of experience playing church music of all kinds. Growing up, I'm actually Catholic. I grew up Catholic, but I spent a lot of time in Baptist churches with friends who played. And being a trumpet player in high school, I had a chance to play many of the great pieces like Handel's Messiah, Bach's Magnificat. One of the advantages of playing trumpet, Giovanni Gabrielli's music from the 16th century, 17th century music. So when I write longer pieces, I tend to have extensive outlines. I do a lot of studying because I want to put a lot of music in my music. Mm-hmm. And I charted out. I sat down with Reverend Butts at the Abyssinian, and I charted out the form. One good thing about a mass is that you know what the form is already. So it's a long form, but it's a form that we're familiar with.
But do the Baptists know what a Mass is?
They know it. They know it. And it's really related to the Latin Mass in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. The Collect is related to the Kyrie, and all of the sections of the original Mass actually are encompassed in the Baptist Mass. But then I begin to integrate all of the material. Like, just to give you an example, the Amen of the Mass at the end of all of what we've played, I made it. The recessional of the Mass, I made be a train, not the Amen, the recessional, because the glory train means you're going from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And in our Afro-American mythology and in American mythology, the train is a symbol of freedom. So you're being freed from the earth and you're going to heaven. So the people say, I'm riding up to heaven on the straight, on the glory train. But mm-hmm. I used a combination of Scott Joplin's march from his opera Tree Manitia called Marching Onward,
right,
and a song that Jobim wrote called the Waters of March, because the Waters of March just list a lot of diverse things and says at the end it includes it's the love in your heart. It's a stick, a stone, it's a something in the wind, it's a this, it's a that. And then I give you a roll call of all of the kind of great figures in the Bible from the Old Testament to the New Testament. And with music, you're able to combine experiences across time and deal in the traditions in a way that allow for a continuum of experience. So.
This piece really, as you talk about it, it becomes apparent that it fulfills a lot of different purposes all at once. It's a commemoration of the 150 years of that church. It is the form of a Mass. It also traverses jazz history, and it also chronicles the African-American experience.
And also the Anglo-American experience, because the Anglo-American experience is the root of the Afro-American experience. So you can't have an Afro-American experience without an Anglo-American experience. It's not possible. Mm-hmm. And I always integrate the two experiences because that's the life that we lead. Mm-hmm. And when we attempt to separate them, then it's like, am I going to take all of your mama out of you and just leave your daddy? That's not possible. You are the innovation. And you're the innovation that resulted from the integration of a diverse set of genes, and those genes come together, and there's a recessive and there's a dominant, but you can't remove one from the other without altering what that innovation is. Mm-hmm. And the same thing is true with American music. It's all related.
I wanted folks to hear a little bit of this, and I did not have access to an actual recording of this, so I resorted to YouTube. So I apologize for the audio quality here, but I want to play a little medley of elements from the Abyssinian Mass.
Was baptized by John in the Jordan stream, tempted of the devil and delivered of angels. Yes, the Lord would reign supreme.
Don't know if that's chronological,
no,
where the piece goes, but maybe now that we've heard some of that, you can tell us what we were listening to.
Well, we were listening to something that was very poorly recorded.
Yes, I know.
First. And
I live to serve.
we heard the snippets of a lot of different moments of it. Everything from a recessional to the end of the sermon called Everyone Has a Place in the House of God, which is really the central theme of the Mass as a kind of conception of unity. It's really what the DNA is telling us about human beings. And in the spiritual experience, it's just saying that the deeper you get into a human being, the more we're similar. And if you get really deep enough, we're not even similar. We are the same.
Did you write the lyrics for all these pieces as well, the sung parts?
Yes, sir. Well, a lot of it comes out of the Bible, so okay. It was not that much to write, but
and,
I did.
And there's a tap dancer in there for a brief amount of time, and I'm curious whether that's in the score or whether that's something you added for this performance.
No, that's an older performance. The only time we did that actually was in New York, the first time we played it in 2008. It's because there's a genius tap dancer there named Jared Grimes, a young man who's so fantastic. And it was kind of a doff in my hat to Duke Ellington's piece that he did in his sacred concert called David Dance Before the Lord. Hmm.
Your brother, Delfio, was on this program several years ago, and we spent some time talking about your family and growing up in New Orleans and growing up in that musical conclave that you and your father created, I guess, you and your mother, surrounded by music, all that musical talent in one family. How do you explain it?
I don't know, but it didn't feel like that when we were growing up so much. You know, my father really was struggling as a musician. He didn't have big audiences and crowds. He had a lot of integrity. So one thing that's given me a lot of fortitude is just seeing him play over the years for 15 and 20 people in a room every night. Mm-hmm. And
I've read other interviews where you've talked about your father having musical integrity. What does that mean?
It means that he was not willing to do the compromises he had to do to have an audience. So he was willing to play, and he was willing to not change his music to make it be popular. He's like the kind of person who won't go along with any type of prejudice or ignorant talk just because the group of people he's around will go with it. He stands in his integrity. When he believes in something, mm-hmm. he'll live and die by it.
Now you, I understand, when you were much younger and before you had made a name for yourself, played in some funk bands and some other kinds of musical organizations, not traditional jazz, not even jazz particularly.
Yeah. And that was all because my father told me to do it.
Did he?
My father's the type of person who believes in experiencing things, and he said, never have an opinion about something you don't know about. Even if you'd be looking at a game with him and you would comment on somebody dropping a ball or something, you'd always say, man, the best way to critique something is to do it. Mm. So I've seen you play. you don't need to critique him. And he was not a person who believed in earning a prejudice. Like, he didn't believe in, I just don't like something or funk is not good. He was like, get in the band and get experience playing and play all kinds of music and learn them. So that when you have something to say about something, it will come from a position of knowledge and not ignorance. He was really that way with people. He hated for you to make any generalization about a person.
But in the 30 seconds we have left, how does that jive with his insistence on remaining true to his musical?
He did that for himself. That's what he had concluded. He came to a conclusion of integrity. And it's something that we all have to come to. We have our own personal standard of integrity we have to come to. Hmm.
Wynton Marsalis is our guest, one of the first, one of the members of the first family of American jazz, essentially, and one of the great trumpet players of our time. We're going to come right back and talk some more. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to an archive version of Charlotte Talks this morning at 9 here, 90.7 WFAE, listener supported public radio. And support this morning comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Radiology, whose 90 plus subspecialized doctors wish everyone a picture perfect holiday season. Information on their 45 locations in Charlotte and surrounding areas available at charlotteradiology.com. New York Times bestselling author Cassandra King discusses her novel Moonrise, her marriage to Southern author Pat Conroy, and more. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Sunshine today in Charlotte, a high expected around 57 degrees, clear tonight, and a low near 33 for tomorrow. More sunshine, a high in the upper 50s. It's 48 degrees.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, classical music today and tomorrow, its place in American culture, the financial health of its institutions, and new efforts to make it more accessible to younger generations.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
Autumn here, Autumn Leaves, Wynton Marsalis, trumpet player, who's with us this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. You received your first trumpet at your sixth birthday from Al Hurt. Doesn't get much better than that, I would think. But I read that you didn't want to play the trumpet at first, and it was all about girls.
Well, yeah, because I didn't want to get that ring. In New Orleans, all the trumpet players' lips are ugly. So I would look at their lips and say, man, I don't want that red thing on my lips. So the girls are not going to kiss me, so I can't. So I didn't practice the trumpet for 6 or 7. I wasn't really serious about it.
How'd you get over that?
Well, then I realized the girls like musicians. So once I understood that, once I puberty, even 12, you start to understand what you don't know at 6 or 7 or 8. You have a suspicion at 7 or 8, you begin to know at 12. You begin to know I need to practice. Because then they will like me.
You're the second your older brother's is Branford, correct?
Yes.
He plays saxophone. You play trumpet. Delphio plays
trombone.
Jason plays
drums.
And your father plays piano. Was he trying to build a band here?
No. They felt that we should all play. And actually, we played very little with each other. Delphio is a lot, 3 or 4 years younger than Branford and I, so that was a big difference when we were growing up. And we didn't really spend a lot of time at home practicing together. And we didn't have the kind of family. We had a typical kind of Southern dysfunctional family, struggling with a lot of kids and not that much money. And it really was not, let's get around the piano and play a bebop tune. So sometimes I just laugh because it sounds a certain way, because we did all end up playing. Mm-hmm. And we did love, respect our father, and we did. And our mother actually had much more music on her side. Wellman Brough, the great a bassist with Duke Ellington's early orchestra, is my great-great-uncle. So a lot of the musicianship came from my mother's side. And, it was a struggle growing up in our family. One thing we did understand from the way we grew up was the reality of working and of playing this music. So we didn't have a kind of Alice in Wonderland concept at all. And it just so ends up, as we grew older, we started to play. I mean, Branford had unbelievable talent. He always had that. But he was not decided he would play jazz. I love jazz, but it was no real work playing it, and I had the opportunity to play it, and I called Branford and said, man, let's get this band together and let's play jazz. Branford was still trying to decide whether he wanted to play jazz, and Delphio and my little brother Ellis, who we call the Oracle, he's the smartest of all of us. So whenever we want to know about something, we call our brother Ellis, and we say, what are we thinking today? And he tells us that, even though he's not a musician, but he started playing guitar, and then he stopped, and we were never forced to play. And it just kind of came about. Our little brother Jason, he was 2 when I left home, so we didn't really play with him except when we would come home. And Delphio wasn't really playing that much when I left home and Branford left home.
You said something interesting a second ago, that there was no work playing jazz, and yet you grew up in New Orleans, and for people who don't live there, we have this impression that music is in every nook and cranny of that city.
That was very much community. It's never something that was really fostered by the city in the early years. Musicians always struggle. There's a lot of prejudice and ignorance in the culture. I mean, we have a statue of Robert E. Lee still up in the center of our city, and I mean, we fell first. So we have a kind of backwards relationship to our culture. If you're from there, you know it, and it's improved somewhat over the years, but it has never been embraced to the degree that Strauss's music is embraced in Vienna or Beethoven or Haydn, and the level of playing has never risen to the level of the early pioneers. We don't necessarily play Jelly Roll Morton's music or there's not a real reflection of Louis Armstrong's, the grandeur and greatness of his playing in all New Orleanians. I don't mean just the black kids in the community that grew up having to get horns and can kind of play in a certain style. I mean, it's something that everybody in New Orleans should know and play. We should be the best in the world at playing our music. It's been reduced to kind of Bourbon Street and the type of music that most of it is not jazz, and it's played on a very poor level. And in spite of that, the music continues because it is a very musical and cultural city. But isn't the music has it's been more embraced after Katrina than it ever was. And certainly when I was growing up, it was not at all embraced. My father and the musicians had a very, very difficult time, and they didn't play some abstract form of jazz. Now, he didn't play traditional jazz. He ended up playing gigs of traditional jazz with Bob French and other traditional musicians. He loved that form of music. He always told me to study with Alvin Alcorn and Teddy Riley and all the great trumpet players who happened to come in the in that tradition. But he was a part of a younger tradition of modern New Orleans music that with Edward Blackwell and people who eventually ended up playing with Ornette Coleman. And he was very conscious, but it was not at all. There are a lot of kind of misconceptions about what it really was like.
So if you weren't working with Lincoln Center and doing the Lincoln Center, Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, and you went back home to New Orleans, what would you do to reform or rebuild music in that
town? I would start with education and getting people together, getting the community people around the art form and realize what the economic opportunities are when you embrace your culture. What your cultural opportunities are, how you can transform your education system with just something that's true and real. Because, you know, when you've been dealing with the artificial and the fake for such a long time, it's like with food. It's interesting. We're talking about the ad about food. They eat well, but eat mainly plants. I always try to tell my daughter that you look at things that you eat that are man-made and look at things that are natural and notice the difference in the texture and the taste of it. But when you get used to that, which is artificial, it takes a little while to get used to that which is natural and that which has a certain integrity. But when you get an understanding of that, you almost never go back to the artificial. And the same thing is true with talking. It's true with games. It's true with and our education system is the same way. I love the way we always talk about education as if just the fact of the word makes something good or of value. The question is, what are you being educated? How are you being taught? And it's like the word communication. I always think, well, I'm just communicating to the people. Well, but what are you communicating to the people? So very much I would go back, and I'm a big believer in value and in integrity and in passing things on with a certain type of love and care and taking your time with things and having a long-term vision. I don't believe in the short-term gain. I'm not a believer in that. I believe in, especially for a continuum, generation after generation after generation, you want to try to create a situation where your generations can build one on the other so that the whole expression and experience of your time is a cultural identity across time. Not let me get as much as I can out of this for my 50 years that I'm down here. But how can we set up something in this time that will resonate for 5,000 years? So that's where I would be coming from. If I were responsible for dealing with our kids, I would have a cultural Olympiad in New Orleans.
Where does that come from in you?
I always had that feeling. You know, I don't know why it's like that. There's certain things you have, you know, and I noticed from teaching so many people, everybody has something. We all have a creativity. We all have a specialness. We all have some type of genius and brilliance. We all have some idea that is given to us. It's a blessing. The great French painter Matisse said, everybody has three ideas. But I find that I've been in the most ignorant environments with people who, many of whom are in jail, that I grew up with. And I'll tell you, it's a level of brilliance in a lot of those people that is astounding for different things. And I've been in the kind of environments where those people have achieved the most, and their level of brilliance is not necessarily higher. They're brilliant in other ways. Mm-hmm. So an understanding of the holistic nature of things, I was always given to that, and an understanding of form.
You were given that trumpet at 6, and you said a few minutes ago that you really didn't practice. You weren't really interested for a very long time. You didn't start practicing until you were 12. 2 years later, at 14, you debuted with the Louisiana Philharmonic. 3 years later, you moved to New York and attended Juilliard. How did you get so good so fast?
I practice. I always worked. And from the time I was 8 years old, I always had jobs. And I was always very organized about practicing. I didn't mind practicing 3, 4, 5 hours a day, every day.
And no one pushed you?
You didn't have to push me. I always push myself. Because you can't push a person to do that. You can't. Nobody can make you stay up all night writing music, or you're not going to get paid commensurate to that level of work. And it didn't matter to me whether it was shooting free throws, being a Boy Scout, doing homework at school, playing ball. I would always practice and work on stuff just because I wanted to be good at it and I wanted to play. And I didn't drive myself crazy doing it. It's just what I did. And it really was not about, look at me. If I just was in my personality and in my, I don't mind working. I don't mind reading every note. I don't mind following every number of something. It doesn't bother me. Like even cutting the lawn or painting the house, it would drive me crazy to cut. We used to have a group of kids when we were 8, 9, 10, and we would cut lawns, and we would argue and compete with whose lawn was the best. Man, it would just drive me crazy if my lawn didn't look like a carpet. And, you know, this is the country, like Kenner, Louisiana. And that wasn't New Orleans, it's Kenner. So you get some good big lawns.
Yeah, there's a school of thought today that every kid should have a trophy, that nobody should ever lose. And what I'm hearing you say is that competition is good. And if there is competition, you're not always going to win. You're not always going to be the best. Have you ever lost?
I've lost a lot. I mean, I can remember concerto competitions I lost. I lost many things just because of prejudice. You know, I grew up when we were just starting integration. And there's a lot that's unfair. And I had a lot of bitterness for a long time about a lot of things I experienced because I was young and very intelligent about social things, whereas a lot of my friends weren't, and mainly because of my mother. So I think you have to understand that the blues teaches us there's hardship in the world, and life is not all a smiley face. And the beauty of it is that you get to overcome it. But the thing is, we all have hardship. And it's not relegated to race or gender or your. I used to tell kids in schools for years, they tell me I'm from the such and such projects or ideas. I say, look, son, we all are from somewhere. We all have something we're dealing with. And the more you know people, you know that life, my great grandma used to say, life has a board for every behind, and yours is fit to your booty. And when it hits you, it hurts. And it's going to continue that way. So we find our we earn our happiness and our joy. And that's what makes us even more joyous. Because if you want something to be sweeter, put a little salt on your tongue. And when you taste that sweetness, it's going to be sweet, sweet, sweet. And jazz is an art form of engagement. It's not an art form of avoidance, you know. And that's why I think I've always been successful teaching kids. Because I don't come in talking to them like, how are we today? And oh, Johnny, and no, they don't want to hear all of that. They want to be incorporated into the flow of life, and they want to feel the love of an adult and an embrace that will lead them into their journey. And our music has all of that in it.
Wow. Wynton Marsalis is our guest. Your work ethic is something that you're known for, and obviously it started when you were a young person. But I read also that you wanted to overcome racism and assert your humanity
right.
through music.
Yes, I did want to do that.
How do you do that?
You do that by being for real. In every instance, be for real. So I don't like to leave things and say I should have said. And I don't care if it would be on the street with all brothers in a barber shop or in a boardroom. It doesn't matter. Be for real. You have a freedom of speech in this country. It's nothing wrong with being wrong. You have the right to express your opinion. Don't let anyone take that right from you. Be heard. And I even taught that to my kids. And a lot of times I was sorry I taught it to them. Because they would tell me stuff, and I would say, I would maim you if I didn't have to pay the doctor's bill. But you have the right to express yourself, and don't. And there's value to it, and it is. And the thing that jazz also teaches through swinging is, I have that right, but you have it too. So you have to develop that mechanism to embrace listening as hard as you embrace talking.
And isn't that the key of truly being able to play with other people as a jazz musician? It's what you can do yourself, but it's also really reacting to what you're hearing.
To react and to embrace what you hear, even though it may be contrary to what you're hearing. So jazz is an art form that has a tremendous depth in terms of not your rights to improvise. Swing means I'm sacrificing. I have to listen to you and follow you and go with you and try to make sense and logic out of what you're saying and change my point of view for the music to be successful.
Yeah, because people who don't play jazz don't understand that. I mean, you have to have an understanding of the underlying melodics and harmonics
right.
of the song, and you have to have, it seems to me, a roadmap of where you think it ought to go, but then the other guy starts it and takes it in a different direction.
That's right. But that framework has to be fundamental and simple and strong, like the Constitution. You know, our federal Constitution is much shorter than almost every state constitution.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like our skeleton, right? It's very firm, but it's very flexible. But you need that skeleton. It's a spine. And I believe that's also true in business. I always say if you have a business, let's look at what our underlying documents are. Are they flexible enough to allow for 1,000 people to get around it? Are they firm enough for that 1,000 to contribute and they don't change? So it's the kind of combination of opposites that we've been kind of talking about in our music. If you don't know the form, you can't play. Like football, you know the form of the game, you can play. If not, it's a bunch of people running into each other for a short time.
You have to know the rules before you can break them.
And the rules have to be fundamental and firm enough for them to allow for your, the expression of your personality. If the rules are too rigid, it's not worth your involvement.
Let's listen to some music, because you're here as a musician and also obviously a great thinker, because it's amazing what's coming out of your mouth. Let's listen to a little bit of something from Standard Time Volume 3. This is a piece you played with your father, Ellis, called The Seductress.
Uh-oh.
A good example of how the trumpet can really be used to sound very much like the human voice. The first time I heard something like this, it was with Clyde McCoy doing Sugar Blues with a Harmon mute. What are you using on that trumpet for that?
That's a regular plunger mute. Mm-hmm. Early musicians would take the bottom end of a toilet plunger and make it function like a lower jaw against the bell of a trumpet. King Oliver from New Orleans was the first real master of a plunger. Louis Armstrong was mentored by him. And then the great Bubba Miley immortalized King Oliver's techniques with Duke Ellington, and then Duke Ellington orchestrated it. Cootie Williams is next great master of plunger playing. He's from Alabama. And then Rex Stewart, I combine like a kind of half valve technique of Rex Stewart. Just gives that whine with kind of Cootie Williams. And I came with my own kind of way of caressing the notes with the plunger to kind of bend the notes. And then there were many other masters of plunger playing, like the great Clark Terry, who was a mentor of mine. And we all try to find our own way to do things, our own take on a fundamental.
You know, you mentioned all these greats, and I know that Duke Ellington was somebody that's very important to you, as somebody who came before you, but you're on the same platform, the same plateau as they are. What is that like? No, you are. What is that like when you look back on, you know, because everybody starts at ground zero. And you build to a certain level, and you've been able to go to the level of the people you admired. What's that like?
Well, I don't think that Duke Ellington, he wrote over 2,000 songs. And when I saw his collected works in the Smithsonian, tears came to my eyes because of the volume of music that he wrote and the clarity of the scores written in his hand. And we're all a part of a continuum. And I don't see my work as individual. I build on all the people who came before me. I don't have a problem. In America, sometimes after the 1950s, we had a problem with our generations, like generation gap and all that. That's a short-lived concept. And I think it was because of the Depression and because World War II. We had two generations of people who had challenges with their parenting. Mm-hmm. Then after World War II, people who had gone through 20 years of suffering, you know, indulge their kids and created a kid culture. I don't believe in that. So I embrace all of them. And I'm happy to just be out here and be a part of it.
Wynton Marsalis, our guest today. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks rebroadcast here at 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. Support today comes from WFAE members and Levine Museum of the New South. Tis the season to visit with family and friends. Information about current exhibits at Levine's new website, museumofthenewsouth.org. You may not always be close to a radio, but you can always check up on the latest local, national, and international news by visiting WFAE.org or using the free WFAE apps. And your unwanted car can help pay for your favorite WFAE programs. Donate it through our Car Talk vehicle donation program. Learn how at WFAE.org. And thanks.
I'm Mark Rumsey, host of All Things Considered on WFAE. From the headlines to the front lines, All Things Considered keeps you connected to what's going on locally, nationally, and around the world.
Safety recalls are even more troubling when the very equipment being recalled is intended to save lives.
Get the story beyond the headlines with All Things Considered, weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 on WFAE.
Here on Charlotte Talks today on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. About 25 years ago, you founded Jazz at Lincoln Center, and today it seems like a perfect fit, something logical to be at Lincoln Center in the heart of New York. Did it feel that way to others when you were working to get it off the ground?
I felt it maybe didn't feel that way to outsiders, but to everyone inside of it, the chairman of the board of Lincoln Center, George Weissman, at that time was a great jazz fan, loved Charlie Parker, and Nate Leventhal, who was the president of Lincoln Center, he loved the music and supported it. All of our early committee members who became our board members were diversity of leaders from the community. They were unbelievably supportive. And of our original 17 board members, we still have 11 of them, and some have passed away. So they believed in it.
I ask because in the early stages, I know that it was not without its critics. What was all the fuss about then, and has it all disappeared?
No, it was mainly racial and social.
Really?
None of it is serious. Yeah, it's all smokescreened. You know, it kind of intelligent people smokescreen their agendas. It's not going to come out and call you a name, but it was very antebellum and Southern, which was fine because there was also a great counterstatement to that, which was all the people who worked on it and made it happen. It's always kind of a threat. One guy counted the number of black and white musicians on the stage once, and I mean, there was a lot of that kind of stuff.
But it's always been, maybe it's a myth, that people said that show business and music were colorblind. I mean, maybe Ella Fitzgerald had to travel on the bus and stay in a different hotel, but on the stage, she was equal to anybody else.
That's musicians. But musicians are not writing articles. Musicians don't. When music becomes a product and it hits the marketplace, that product traditionally has demanded it. You want to be popular with teenagers, you got to do something with your hair. You want to get across. People look at me and Willie Nelson as a perfect example. They say, wow, you know, you have a suit on. Willie Nelson has a cowboy hat on. It must be really different to be with him. Man, Willie Nelson's from Texas. I'm from Louisiana. We have more natural, basic things in common, and we never discuss whether I have a suit on and his cowboy hat. The songs we play all come from the same tradition. The food we eat comes from the same region of the but when it's a product and there's a group of people around it, it becomes he's like country, he's this, he's Texas, he's white, it's all, but that's not the reality of it.
So what do you think you've accomplished over 25 years with Jazz at Lincoln Center?
I feel that we have done so many things in our education programs and bringing people together through swing and removing the kind of illusion about the divisions, that things that separate us that are not real. Jazz Lincoln Center has been very successful at demonstrating, not just racially, generationally. We still have work to do from a gender standpoint, but we've come a long way in a lot of ways.
You know, I don't know how you feel about contemporary music. I know how I feel about it. Music, like everything else, goes through stages. Styles change. Jazz was once new. It was once cutting edge, and in many ways it still is. But today, it's really hard to find jazz on the radio or in clubs outside of major cities. Your teenage son, Wynton Marsalis, you say, listens to more commercial music. I'm not sure what that means, but I think I have an idea, which you believe is relevant but not interesting as from a musical standpoint. Talk about where we are today in popular music and why we're there.
Well, we're in the same place in music that we are as a country. We see what's going on with our government, with our financial systems. We're struggling. We have a lack of integrity. We have a problem, and we all know it, and we're experiencing it. We're living in a time where it's survival of the fittest, and civilization is an effort. And we have great arts, and they're always, I'm heartened because there are always people all over the world, the Knight Foundation. Let's think of the people who came together to make this happen. the Arts and Science Council, a church, you know, missionary. It's a stretch for everybody, but they're willing to make that stretch, and people came out. And I've seen this time and time again across the United States of America. We as a nation just have not put together yet the value of culture. We are uncultured. How do you expect kids, people to grow up in uneducated in any art, and then you're going to give them your national art form, which you established before when there was some type of education and aspiration for an artistic kind of civilized sense of who you are as a group? How are you going to treat them as if they're a market and sell them products that are degenerating every generation and say, boy, it's a shame about these kids? So, you know, even though my kids do listen to popular music, it's kind of hard not to. The level of pornography is so high, it's hard to tell a 13-year-old, don't put these videos on. It's all out here. The one advantage they have had is that because they're always around the music, I didn't force them. You can't stop them from listening to what they listen to. They've all come around to the music. And there's been every instance of I have a 25, a 23, and a 17-year-old in terms of my older boys. My daughter's too young still. And they've all come around to the music and say, man, we can actually hear the music, and we like the music, and we understand the difference between what we're listening to. My 17-year-old son was a DJ. When he was 13 and 14, I was just driving me crazy. By the time he was 17, he was listening to Ahmad Jamal and Train unforced. I said, man, there's a big difference between Train and...
How did he get there?
He's always around it. I exposed him to the music. And this music is about that. It's not about Vibes Cartel or whatever this stuff is that y'all are listening to. This stuff is so absurd and ridiculous. And I'm also not shocked by it. It's not cutting edge.
You want this to be a country of the arts. And I was going to ask you on a scale of 1 to 10 where you think we are today, and 10 being the country of the arts, 1 being nothing. I get an idea. I think I know what you're going to say. But where do you think we are?
I think we're a 1.
Wow. I was going to say 5.
No way. I go to other countries. No way in the world are we are 5. If you look at where the national endowment is in relation to the rest of our national budget, that's going to tell you where we are. Where our tax money is getting stolen anyway. Just look at a pie chart. Google it. Look at the pie chart. And if you look at that pie chart, it's going to tell you exactly.
So make the case. Make the case. Why should we be a country of the arts? Obviously, if we're 1, we're uncultured. So make the uncultured understand what it would mean to them to be appreciative of culture.
It means, first, that we're able to speak to one another, and we understand that we have a mutual heritage that's worth protecting and developing. That's first. So once you understand that you have something mutual that you're working on with other people, you're no longer adversarial in the same way. You have a common goal. Just a common goal alone. In jazz, that common goal is swinging. One person cannot swing alone. It takes a group. And that means you have to find that other person. So that's 1. The only other thing I'll say is Odysseus observed in the Odyssey, he would ascertain whether people were civilized or not by the level of their hospitality. And the arts are the calling card of hospitality. Here's some food we have. Here's our painting. Here's our literature. Anywhere you go, people are going to present you with their art because that's hospitality. What are we presenting them with?
Trumpet player, songwriter, jazz, and classical musician Wynton Marsalis, recorded last year. We close this Christmas program with a poem written several years ago by Tom Haig. Tom's an actor in Minneapolis who wrote this poem to be read at a Christmas program at his church. He was one of several other speakers on the bill, all of whom had been rewarded with enthusiastic applause when they were through. But when Tom finished his reading, he left the stage to silence.
He believed he'd failed. In fact, he had succeeded beyond his wildest dreams. The audience was silent at first because they were so moved by his words. Then, gradually, they rewarded him with sustained applause. Well, that poem has gone on to be published and spawned a small industry of Christmas objects, all themed to the title of the poem, which sums up the spirit of Christmas, a cup of Christmas tea.
The log was in the fireplace, all spiced and set to burn. At last, the yearly Christmas race was in the clubhouse turn. The cards were in the mail, all the gifts beneath the tree, and 30 days reprieve till Visa could catch up with me. And though smug satisfaction seemed the order of the day, something still was nagging me and would not go away. A week before, I got a letter from my old great aunt. It read, "Of course I'll understand completely if you can't, but if you find you have some time, how wonderful if we could have a little chat and share a cup of Christmas tea." She'd had a mild stroke that year, which crippled her left side. Though housebound now, my folks had said it hadn't hurt her pride. They said she'd love to see you. What a nice thing it would be for you to go and maybe have a cup of Christmas tea. But boy, I didn't want to go. Oh, what a bitter pill to see an old relation and how far she'd gone downhill. I remembered her as vigorous, as funny, and as bright. I remembered Christmas Eve's when she regaled us half the night. I didn't want to risk all that. I didn't want the pain. I didn't need to be depressed. I didn't need the strain. And what about my brother? Why not him? She's his aunt, too. I thought I had to justify, but then before I knew the reasons not to go, I so painstakingly had built were cracking wide and crumbling in an acid rain of guilt. I put on boots and gloves and cap, shame stinging every pore. And armed with squeegee, sand, and map, I went out my front door. I drove in from the suburbs to the older part of town. The pastels of the newer homes gave way to gray and brown. I had that disembodied feeling as the car pulled up and stopped beside the wooden house that held the Christmas cup. How I got up to her door, I really couldn't tell. I watched my hand rise up and press the button of the bell. I waited, aided by my nervous rocking to and fro. And just as I was thinking I should turn around and go, I heard the rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall, the triple beat of 2 feet, and a crutch came down the hall. The clicking of the door latch and the sliding of the bolt, and a little swollen struggle popped it open with a jolt. She stood there, pale and tiny, looking fragile as an egg. I forced myself from staring at the brace that held her leg, and though her thick bifocals seemed to crack and spread her eyes, their milky and refracted depths lit up with young surprise. "Come in! Come in!" she laughed the words, and she took me by the hand, and all my fears dissolved away as if by her command. We went inside, and then before I knew how to react, before my eyes and ears and nose was Christmas past, alive, intact. The scent of candied oranges, of cinnamon and pine, the antique wooden soldiers in their military line, the porcelain nativity I'd always loved so much, the Dresden and the crystal I'd been told I mustn't touch. My spirit fairly bolted like a child out of class and danced among the ornaments of calico and glass. Like magic, I was 6 again, deep in a Christmas spell, steeped in the million memories the boy inside knew well. And here among old Christmas cards so lovingly displayed, a special place of honor for the ones we kids had made. And there, beside her rocking chair, the center of it all, my great aunt stood and said how nice it was I'd come to call. I sat and rattled on about the weather and the flu. She listened very patiently, then smiled and said, "What's new?" Thoughts and words began to flow. I started making sense. I lost the phony breeziness I use when I get tense. She was still passionately interested in everything I did. She was positive, encouraging, like when I was a kid. Simple generalities still sent her into fits. She demanded the specifics, the particulars, the bits. We talked about the limitations that she'd had to face. She spoke with utter candor and with humor and good grace. Then, defying the reality of crutch and straightened knee, on wings of hospitality, she flew to brew the tea. I sat alone with feelings that I hadn't felt in years. I looked around at Christmas through a thick, hot blur of tears. And the candles and the holly she'd arranged on every shelf. The impossibly good cookies that she still somehow baked herself. But these rich, tactile memories became quite pale and thin when measured by the Christmas my great aunt kept deep within. Her body halved and nearly spent, but my great aunt was whole. I saw a Christmas miracle, the triumph of the soul. The triple beat of 2 feet and a crutch came down the hall. The rattle of the china in the hutch against the wall. She poured 2 cups. She smiled. And then she handed one to me. And then we settled back and had a cup of Christmas tea.
Tom Hegg's A Cup of Christmas Tea, a poem quickly dashed off on a piece of yellow legal pad paper, but destined to become a Christmas classic. And that's our show for Christmas Day. All of us at Charlotte Talks and at WFAE wish you and your family great happiness on this holiday, with many more to come. I'm Mike Collins.